Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had the taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Poetry allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of the show, recognize they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulder. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. We are coming to you from Late Night Poets, which is a group on allpoetry.com. And you don't have to be a part of the group to participate, but it's more fun if you do. We are posting the poems as we read them in the group, and you can follow along in the chat. Or you can always call in. So to call in, the number is 657-383-0024 to join us and share your poetry. Babbler, how are you tonight?
Doing all right. How are you doing?
Great. I just went to the night market, which is like the farmer's market, but the evening version. And it was great. I haven't been for like 2 years. So it's a farmer's market, and then there's all these kinds of like artsy, like craft kind of things. It's basically like the hippie hangout, but I love it.
Nice. I know Asia has a lot of night markets. Not you don't find too many of them in the U.S.
More of an Asian thing. So that's cool.
It's a small town Canada thing too.
Well, that's a good thing. I don't know. I always thought they were kind of cool.
It's nice. It's a little more crowded than I'm comfortable with right now. I've been avoiding crowds forever, but still, it was nice to get out and see all the things and eat some really good frozen yogurt.
Nice. Still got all the wildfire craziness going on, or has that died down a bit?
It's still happening. It's a little bit further away from me, but again, it's on the other side now. There's so many fires in BC right now. It's just insane. And people are starting them on purpose now. I don't understand. I'm like, we've already lost some towns and like huge sections of forest. And then there's arsonists. I'm like, it's nuts.
Crazy.
Why are you trying to burn down the province? I don't understand. So it's pretty smoky. It's really smoky here. It's kind of like someone just, you know, spit a cigarette in your face. Not spit, but like blew the smoke, but like at all times. There was this restaurant that was advertising locally, and it was so cute because they're like, did you know you can get all of our food smoked now? And they just like hold it out the window. Like, there you go. Smoked salmon.
Optimism at its best.
Yeah.
All the salmon comes pre-smoked from this region.
Yep.
I like it. You know, in a black kind of humor way.
Yes. I appreciated it. So tonight's contest is based on Sweet Tooth, which is a comic book series that is also a TV series on Netflix. I've ordered the comic books. I haven't actually read the comics first. I'm a terrible librarian. I watched the show, and then I'm reading the book. I'm doing it totally backwards. But as I was enjoying the show, because there's a narrator, I was like, this really sounds like it should have been a book. And then I'm like, oh, it was. Anyway, I picked some quotes from the show that I believe are also from the book, although I haven't read the book yet. So the quotes are, when things fall apart, we find out who we really are. And that was said by the narrator. Prompt two, great leaders are created in the most unexpected of places, but the worst, they are made the old-fashioned way. And then that's again said by the narrator. Prompt three, if we can see past the fear, we can find out what really matters. And we learn that sometimes the things that set us apart can also bring us together. And that was said by Big Man, which is what they call the one character, because he's just like this big, kind of intimidating guy who originally is hunting the main character, but is too nice and ends up taking care of him. So he just calls him Big Man. Hey, Big Man, are you on my side now? He's just so cute. Anyway, that was the inspiration for tonight, and we got some interesting responses to it. And we do have a couple little odds and ends of things that are not in the contest that we'll just do for fun as well. And let's see. I see Victoria on the board, but I don't think she's with us on the phone. She's just listening. Hi, Victoria. And Pam is working in the background tonight. So thank you, Pam, for handling our behind-the-scenes stuff. Okay. So I'm going to get started with one by Peter Solway. If you'll read this one for us, Babbler.
Absolutely. All right. Hold on one second. There it is. This is Beyond Fear by Peter Solway. I, the scenic drive, place of plenty, go blind, deaf as granite, not worry like a wartime president, Helen Keller in fine memory, feeling the tap turned on, wish of names, hot and cold along future lines, Jupiter, Saturn, pictures from cosmic silence, Helen to boil a dish without hurting herself, smile at mad nothing. End poem.
Great read. This is really interesting. And what a challenge it would be for Helen to do something like boiling water to cook because she was blind and deaf. And yet she was quite successful. She was, you know, functioning independently even without those two major senses, which is really impressive to me. And so this is interesting of Peter to use her as a context for going beyond fear and to smile despite not being able to have that stimulus of seeing something beautiful or hearing something, to, I think, be in your own mind more and find other ways to see. So this is a really interesting piece. What did you think of it?
I really thought it was interesting because there's so many different places you can go with it as far as internalizing the world in a way. You know, starting with a scenic drive, you know, something that normally you wouldn't imagine Helen Keller would be able to appreciate, except that, you know, just because you appreciate it. You know, maybe the soothing silence, maybe the long drive, maybe just the moments of being in a car with someone. You know, like there's so many things that you can't speak to that are someone else's experience, you know, because then it's followed by a place of plenty, you know. So it's not like some empty, devoid, boring thing, you know. It's just a different way of experiencing. And then I was intrigued by the line, too, not worried like a wartime president, you know, just to not be concerned with the goings-on of others or, you know, like things that are going to come. It almost feels like a live in the moment. You know, don't worry so much about what's going on outside of yourself. You know, maybe take some more time to internalize things, which I thought was interesting. You know, Jupiter, Saturn, pictures from cosmic silence, Helen to boil a dish without hurting herself, smile at mad nothing. You know, you can't hear space. There's no sound in space. And sometimes people can accomplish and do and reach things that you don't imagine that they can do just because you're defining your own limitations is kind of what I get from this. I think it's about like self-reflection and maybe considering different ways of experiencing things. That's what I get from this anyway. I thought it was a really intriguing piece to kind of start with a setting about a scenic drive and then to touch into Helen Keller as, you know, a kind of a focus on how to perceive the world. I definitely thought this was interesting. So I thought it was a great write.
You know, I like what you were saying about how in space you can't really hear anything, and it would be really dark, too, in most, depending on where you are in relation to the sun. So, again, not being able to see, but you can still experience things. And that it just makes me think about how when I was a kid, I was always baffled by when the teacher was talking about how there couldn't possibly be life on these other planets because there wasn't the air and water and things that people need. And I was thinking, well, you don't know what an alien needs. You know, like, just because we need those things doesn't mean that they would. I was like, there are animals who live under the water. There are animals who live in completely different climates that humans can't accomplish. And I'm like, who's to say that there's not something that has evolved differently to need those environments? So I don't know. For some reason, when you're talking about how space is different for what senses are needed, that's all I could think about was me as a child going, there could totally be aliens there. What are you talking about? and just thinking about her in the car ride, like you say, on the scenic drive, she can't see it and she can't necessarily hear anything, but you feel the movement of the car. You might smell the different areas, like if you're driving through the woods or something. There's other sensory inputs. And I really liked what you said about not worrying about what everyone else is doing, just kind of like focusing on what's happening internally. And I think this is a really thought-provoking, right, is you can kind of think about how you experience things and then realize that not everyone experiences things the same ways. It's very cool.
Yeah.
So thank you, Peter, for submitting that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I thought it was great, right? Where do you want to head next?
We have one by Eric Svensson that I'm going to read. This is called The Piano Tuner. And it was put to prompt 3, the one that's, if we can see past the fear, we find out what really matters, and we learn that sometimes the things that set us apart can also bring us together, because family is what we make it, each one of us together. Piano tuner. Mark these piano tuner days. Dark ebony keys flounder. Dragnet news reports more COVID deaths. Ivory keys fight back. Lighthouse cling to hope's stark cliff. Honky-tonky piano off-kilter. Sounds so hollow. Frustration's wrench snaps scarce wires. Pedals skew from angst-ridden presses. How to save this abused bar institution? Mahler compositions stream through befuddled minds. Macabre dissonance dances daily. Fortitudes, ivory keys, fight back. Encourage ebony keys to persevere. Where's all the honky-tonky music gone? Piano tuner beholds his passion, restores the dilapidated instrument to its joyful self. Bar patrons watch absent-mindedly, eyes superglued to television screen. Intermittent pandemic reports pander more apocalypse. Satisfaction, smiles, sunrises, the piano tuner's face. He sits down, clear his throat. Skilled finger hit the first notes. Bold baritone voice belts out, pack up your troubles in the old kit bag. Gradually eyes unlock from garish news. Specter like they stare at the piano tuner. Lost ember coals flame up. Some reminisce somewhere kicks in. Are we really in the Third World War Nostradamus spoke about? End poem.
Great read, Afasiana. I really enjoyed this piece just about, you know, current times, essentially, and how so many people are transfixed by all of the horrible things happening in the news and in the media, and in some cases, you know, a little more close to home with people that you know and care about. But there is other pieces of life, you know, there are the things that we enjoy. In this case, you know, piano tuners, love for music and ability to play. There are so many things, you know, that nobody told you that you had to give up on. But it just feels that way, you know, with the constant feeding of negativity. And so I think this is a really nice call to be like, hey, you know, the world is still moving. Like, life is still going on. There is still joy. There are still good things. You can tune an out-of-tune piano and make it sound beautiful again. You know, you can go back to some of the things in your life that you enjoyed before everything seemed so horrible. You know, the idea of sitting in a bar with a bunch of downtrodden people focusing on all of the things that make life horrible and then, you know, starting to play a piano and pull them out of it and bring them back into a moment where not everything is bad,
and make them realize that, hey, not everything is bad, is an important thing. You know, I've certainly gone through some weird cycles, especially during COVID, with a lot of ups and downs. But I'm pretty in a good place at the moment, coming out of this and picking up new hobbies and finding new things that make me happy again. And in some ways, I feel like it's increased my appreciation for the relationships and friendships that I do have, because sometimes you don't realize it until you've missed it. You know, I miss going to birthday parties. I miss having dinner occasionally with my friends. I miss going to movies, you know, just simply going to a bar or a restaurant. And I look forward to doing all of those things again. But in some ways, I feel like I've also been afforded the opportunity to get in better touch with myself. So it's been a weird time. And I think that a lot of interesting and complex poetry has come out of it as well. And I really appreciate this piece's cry to look at the more positive, you know. It talks about, like, the negativity in the media, of course, but it also talks about taking and fixing and improving on out-of-tune things, you know, broken things, and using them as tools to repair relationships and bring people together, which I think is really important, especially right now where everything feels so distant and disjointed. I mean, it doesn't even have to be COVID. You know, it can be these things like the forest fires or like the horrible flooding that's happening in China right now and just kind of things globally. So I think this is a really important and kind of poignant message. And so I really appreciate the poem and seeing it through the lens of a piano tuner. So I think it's a beautiful piece. What did you think?
Well, I think that was a beautiful comment, first of all. And I think what you say speaks to the experience of a lot of people where we now appreciate things that we've taken for granted and at the same time have learned more about ourselves. I think a lot of people have actually taken up new hobbies and learned new ways to be creative and been more introspective and good things have come out of the bad things. And I think that this is a beautiful piece that touches on the perseverance that we can have and to share the little positive things with people and show that things can be repaired. I really liked the lines, frustrations wrench snap scarce wires, petals skew from angst-ridden presses. And I'm just picturing someone really angrily playing the piano. This damaged it because, you know, they were quite passionate in their playing and maybe singing as they were doing it, and they're in a bad place when they were doing this music, and it showed in the way that the poor piano was beaten up. And then here's this person who has a passion for music and pianos and fixes it, gives it the love that it needs, and then plays it in a skillful way that cheers everyone up. And I really liked the line, lost ember coals flame up. And I can just picture that in their eyes. You know, they have those dead, sad eyes. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh. And they light up in that way that, like, they're suddenly awake and paying attention and wanting to be in the moment. I can picture that in their expressions. I also love the reference to Nostradamus because that's just interesting and cool. This is really a great piece. And like you said, it doesn't have to specifically be about COVID, although that's how I'm feeling it right now. It can be about many different things. And in the show / comic books, they are in a pandemic situation. It's not COVID exactly, but it is an illness, and plus the thing about the mutants. It's kind of a similar situation where they've been isolated, and there's a lot of negativity, and then this little boy is like super optimistic considering, like, he's been isolated his whole life. He's never been in the world as we see it. And he's just so curious about everything and, you know, wants to bring back the things from his father's stories. And I see that hope from Gus in this poem. I love it.
Yeah, there is a relentless hope to this piece. It's in like an angry, crying kind of hope. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great write.
Angry crying hope. I like that. That's my style right there. Pam, if you can hear me, can we please have one of the audios from Lynn? I know there are two. This one is called Night and Day.
Night and day. If we can get beyond our differences, we could combine our strengths. It's easy to see you complete me as I inherently complete you. If we can only focus on tomorrow and discard the bogus rubble, sun and moon would rise in all their glory on the palette of our horizon. If only you and I agreed to combine and mesh our strengths as one, we'd face the future head on and get done what we must.
Oh, that was a wonderful SoundCloud, and thank you, Lynn. SoundClouds are always appreciated. It's so nice to hear the author's voice. It just really adds another dimension to the pieces. I loved the directness of this piece. You know, if opposites could only work together. There's so many things that get missed because people who disagree don't want to join up. And I mean, you know, the obvious one that comes to mind is politics, but there's so many other things. You know, it's opposites on all ends of the spectrum. In so many different ways, different insights and different ways of thinking. And if you can take two diametrically opposed things and put them together, you know, I think there's a lot of solutions and a lot of answers and a lot of way things work to, like in the example of night and day. You know, you have to have the day to follow the night, and you have to have night to follow the day, otherwise neither one ends, and they become essentially meaningless. You know, I go through this so many times in my own personal life, you know, even at work, where people will argue, and then they step away and are like, oh, I just get so mad about arguing. But that argument is what brings a lot of ingenuity. It brings a lot of change. You know, that's what brings the revitalization. And if you only had one person there making all the decisions, there's so many better things that we've accomplished for having opposing views that would have never happened without it. And, you know, there's the political, obviously, as well. Where I'm that weirdo who won't delete people for their political views, but I'll certainly talk to them about it in person. You know, I think sometimes we forget that people are human and not just mouthpieces for political platform, unless you're literally a paid mouthpiece for a political platform, but then not most people, that's not the case. So I really liked this. I think it's painted very artfully. It feels very tender. And in some ways romantic, you know, but I don't think it's so much about as like actually romancing the opposite in like a sexual kind of way as much as it is to very tenderly be like, it's okay that we're different. And not only is it okay, it's good. We need that, you know, it feels very kind of yin and yang and natural. So I really enjoyed this. There's so many messages you know, tucked into such a little short 12-line brevity. So I think it's a beautiful piece. Thank you, Lynn. What did you think of Asiana?
I agree that it's beautiful. I find Lynn's voice so soothing. I absolutely love her audios. It just, like, calms me right down. I liked the idea of mesh our strengths as one, because it's true. Usually people who are different have different strengths. And sometimes when you have a team, you need the people who are good at different things. If you're with someone who has the exact same strengths as you and is too much like you, then you're kind of competing to do the same thing rather than being able to complement each other by doing the opposite parts of things. Like with my husband, I think he's very, like, mathematical and is very good at, like, spatial recognition and stuff like that, where I'm awful at those things, and I'm more intuitive and creative. I mean, he has creativity too, but it's just like the opposite sides of things. And I think that that works. And not just in romantic situations, but like for coworkers or things like that. Like if you have different strengths, it can be a good thing. I like that she recognizes that. And I liked the line, discard the bogus rubble. You know, set aside the past problems that really are probably clinging to things that aren't even significant or maybe even real. Just bogus rubble amused me as a way of putting that. Thank you, Lynn, for the audio. Mm-hmm. I know we have another one from her later that was a carryover from a past contest, too. So we got double the Lynn tonight.
Woohoo!
All right, what comes next? I'm going to get you to read the one by Kels.
Alrighty.
I don't believe she's calling. Here we go.
All right, this is I Ain't No Buttercup by Kel Smiles. Not to sound cliche, it's true, strength is found within us through the hardships we face. I found strength in my fear. I found an escape in books, pages of other lived places, realities of life hard to face. Learned I could no longer hide after birthing my first girl child, 3 years after I ended a marriage of condescension. Not much is as provoking of fear than raising a child alone. To me, I was very naively young, afraid a shadow could do harm. Second marriage was no better. Factually, worse than the first, love became pregnant, a girl plus, 3 steps I truly adore. Doubts of my love kicked in. I didn't want to be alone again. Realized I'd be better off with a man who lies too much. Alone again, only now with 2. I can do this. I have no choice. Life threw lemons. I suck it up. Learned I ain't no buttercup. Instead grew stronger in time. My youngest had cancer at 9. Fear was a constant companion, a fuel that kept us both alive. But by then I also had a son, a friend, certainly not a father. Oh no, he couldn't be bothered. Abort his ideal. No, I have a son. There's more, a lifetime more. No longer is fear my enemy. Friends walking hand in hand, face to face, giving me strength. Well, this was a really powerful piece. So I really appreciate Kel sending this in. I tried to take everything with a little bit of grain of salt because this is poetry, but, you know, it feels like a personal right. I like the phrase, I ain't no buttercup. You know, like, I'm not just a silly little pretty little flower. I'm not a delicate little thing. And the hardship that had to go to learn that, you know, it sounds like, you know, three children without fathers in the view and 2 failed marriages at least, not to mention, you know, cancer and just a lack of support. You know, that doesn't sound like a gravy train by any means. It sounds like a really hard and difficult time. But it's also empowering, you know.
I learned I'm not a delicate little flower. Like, I have a backbone. I got to do what I got to do. And there's also mentions in here, you know, of a friendship, other people to help you out. Like, you don't have to be alone. There are good people out there. There are friends that can help you out and rely on. They may not be there all the time, because sometimes that's just how life works. But I really appreciated this write, and just, I, you know, it felt like an exploration of finding out you have a spine, and just what that's made of. So I enjoyed this. It felt like, you know, while it's like, hey, here's some difficult things I've gone through, this isn't about pity. It's about discovering what I can do as a human being. So I really enjoyed it, and kudos to Kel. What did you think, Faziana?
You know, I agree. I like that you use the word empowering, because I did feel that here. You know, it talks about a lot of challenges, and, you know, it sounds like she faced a lot of adversity, having, you know, marriages that didn't go well, and especially, like, the child with cancer, and, like, a lot of challenges, and yet she has this strength. And there's a part where she said, like, fear kept us, fear was a constant companion, a fuel that kept us both alive. And fear does have its benefits, you know. It can be troublesome. I have anxiety disorders. I'm afraid of things I shouldn't be afraid of. So that can be a challenge. But fear in the right time can be something that makes you do what you have to do. It can be a fuel. And to choose to use it that way is really smart. And this did feel empowering. Like, despite the fact that she had these challenges, she had a good attitude, and she kept her family together. She did what she had to as a mom, and I feel this strength, and I Ain't No Buttercup is really cute, and I can just picture her saying it with strength, and I kind of want to have, like, a toolbox with a buttercup that's, like, all pumped up, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, kind of, like, arms for leaves.
Well, I just
not your regular buttercup.
I just want to say, the defense of buttercups, okay? You know, they are in the ranunculus family, which is a beautiful decorative flower, all right? They are bright, and they are sunny, and they are also a weed that is incredibly difficult to get rid of. So I just want to say, you know, buttercups, maybe not so bad.
This is true. I like buttercups, and yet I like the way she defines herself as separate from that.
But anyway, yeah, I thought it was a beautiful piece, and I did. I think it well articulated strength, you know, a feminine kind of strength. So excellent, right?
Agreed. Here we go. I'm going to read one by Teodora Anderson. Fear Can Be Tasted a Mile Away, by Teodora Anderson. He stormed up the walkway, pounding on my door, barking, pointing, demanding for his 3 feet of driveway. Years vanished in his red face as I had become the enemy to be feared. Lines were drawn thick by him between vaccinated and unvaccinated, and patriotic and unpatriotic. No gray shades here, only black and white in this invisible war, and what had been regurgitated and vomited every day. Silence, or you will be shut down. If you are not one of us, you're one of them. But I am one of the good guys. I wear butterfly on my face and distance myself from anyone with 2 legs. The school bells will be sounding soon. Will people fear the butterfly on the face and despise the choice that has been made? Hate me if you must. a pressure cooker, and bribery are what's supposed to bring us together when fear can be tasted a mile away. End poem.
Great read, Afasiana. I enjoyed this poem. I feel like the short lines were really impactful. You know, and this is a thing, too, that I think is really kind of happening currently. You know, the vaccinated versus unvaccinated people labeling each other as, you know, the enemy or evil. Again, important to remember, we are all people. We are all people. And everyone is doing their best to do what they think is the right thing and the best thing. And I, at least for me, even if I don't agree with their choices, which in many cases I don't, you know, they do have the right to make those choices. And I do believe that most people are making the decisions that they think are the best, for themselves and others. But, you know, it is rooted in fear. It really is. So much of what gets twisted into hate and anger and labeling is really just fear. People are afraid of things. They're afraid of dying. They're afraid of getting sick. They're afraid of the unknown. They're afraid of cultures that they don't understand. They're afraid of feeling other, you know, and I think that this is really kind of what it gets at, because nobody views themselves as the bad guy. Everybody views themselves as the good guy and the one who's making the right decision. But then, you know, I kind of twist here, you know, will people fear the butterfly on the face? And in that sentence where they're talking about other people's fear, they're also talking about their own internal fear of rejection. You know, like what's going to happen when I have to go back out into public? You know, will people accept me or not? And the idea that the fear can be tasted a mile away, I think, is a real thing. I think this is a very powerfully written piece that touches on, you know, a really pressing issue of today. You know, I wish there weren't quite so many things delineating people right now, and that we could remember a little better that we're all human, even if we don't agree. So I liked this piece. I thought it was an interesting narrative. It almost feels like some kind of beginning to a post-apocalyptic novel, but a little too real for that. So I think it was a great write. Thank you, Teodora. And what did you think, Viviana?
I think it was really powerful in its perspective as well. And using the neighbors as like a microcosm, showing like what's happening on a larger scale through this conflict of the two neighbors, I thought was really great. The short lines, I agree, were powerful, like barking, pointing, demanding. It made me pause when reading it because it's only that one word on the line, plus punctuation sometimes after just one word, and that really makes you think that like there is each of those words is important. The barking, the pointing, the demanding—it adds strength to it. It feels abrupt, like the pointing and demanding would have been. I liked years vanished in his red face as I had become the enemy. And you can see a change in the expression when you suddenly become the other in someone who, even if you were kind of friendly before, when they realize that you're on the opposite side of things, sometimes there is that kind of click and you can tell in their face. And I thought that this was really good, the way it showed that there is sometimes no in-between allowed, no gray shades here, only black and white. And I like that it's described as the invisible war. I also really liked the use of butterfly to describe the mask. I wear a butterfly on my face. The will people fear the butterfly on my face. I felt like that tonight at the market. I still wear my mask if I'm around lots of people. I work with children who can't be immunized, so I'm very cautious about that. And I was just about the only person at the same time who had a mask. So I did find people were looking at me like, why are you doing this? But, you know, we do what we have to do. And I thought this was a really nice poem in the way that it portrayed that. And I do think it was a great representation of bigger issues through a conflict of two people, and that's a beautiful thing you can do with writing.
Yeah, I also wear my mask
still frequently in public, and it's so funny. I've gotten so many different reactions to it recently. You know, some people say thank you, other people are like, why are you wearing that? You don't have to wear that. And I'm just like, you know, all right.
Yeah, I know. It's very, very for me.
But, mm-hmm. You know, it's a mixed bag for sure of reactions that I get when I wear my mask out and around. But, you know, there's some countries who are wearing the mask when they didn't feel well or felt like they might be getting sick that have been doing it for a long time. It's not like it's a new thing.
I figure if I'm wrong, then I'm not hurting anybody by taking extra precautions. So, whatever.
No harm. Yeah.
I'd rather err on the side of caution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put your poem up now. Actually, I already have. I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay. Let me go and get to the board. All right, this is Slice. The gods took a lash to me before I exited the womb, slicing gouges into my DNA, kidneys winking at the fate, hinting at the cysts they would become. Cracked open again as I learned to stumble through fields of shattered glass, piecing together his mental illness from the tattered bits left behind. Familiar with the curves of my mother's back, racking my mind for the color of her eyes, I can't recall. Forest morsels shoved in a new cut mouth, failing to fill out a fragile frame. Sinew twisting through jagged ribs, shielding a relentless beat. Despite the scars, or maybe because of them, I learned how not to fall, leaving bloody footprints in the broken glass on the way to softer landscapes, thatched in pain, shoes cobbled of scars, pitted belly aching to devour some softness before I turn all to scars and pustules. End poem.
Great read. And a striking piece. It's very dark and interesting. The shoes cobbled of scars. I love that line. And I can just, the imagery of leaving bloody footprints in the broken glass, that is quite the statement right there. I really liked slicing gouges into my DNA, and that it's happening like before you're even born, that things are starting to go wrong. Very dark and very interesting and well put together. You have some excellent phrasing here. Sinew twisting through jagged ribs. But it's really strong, and I, for some reason, I love that sinew and twisting both have a W in them, and it just the two words sound really good together. I feel like I have to read this a couple of times to fully appreciate every bit of it, but I think you did an excellent job here.
Thank you. This one's kind of written on the fly, but I mean, I guess I'll go into it a little bit. You know, it's kind of about my childhood. You know, the slicing gouges into my DNA. I was born with something called PKD, which is polycystic kidney disease, which basically says that at some point in my life, all of the cells in my kidneys are going to turn to cysts. Like, I will need a kidney transplant at some point in my life. It's an autosomal dominant genetic disorder, so fun times there.
I am lucky. I have type 2, not type 1. Most people who have type 1 would have already needed a transplant by my age, so I'm fortunate in that respect. You know, and then I also have bipolar, which me and my mom sat down the other day. We had a really interesting conversation because she was talking about how, like, everyone in my family has some kind of mental problem. And then we literally sat there and talked about it, and there is not a single person on my father's side of the family that doesn't have some kind of mental illness. Not one. Not a single person. You know?
Wow.
And they're a big family. You know, my dad has 6 siblings, and they are Appalachian hillbillies. There are a lot of kids, and they all, every single one of them, has something, whether it's severe agoraphobia. You know, I can think of at least 5 people right off the top of my head that's an issue that they have, or some version of bipolar or borderline personality disorder. But it's literally, there's not a single member of that side of my family that doesn't have one of those 2 issues, which is just absolutely remarkable. I think that says something about the genetics of, you know, the predisposition there is pretty clear cut. But I hadn't realized that actually until literally the other day when my mom and I were just talking about it. You know, and then, of course, my father also passed away when I was really little. And when that happened, my mom went through this really terrible grieving process. You know, she's been widowed twice now. And I can't imagine what it would have been like to be 34 years old and to have 2 husbands have passed away and be left with 5 children. You know, what that must have been like for her, like, and just like how unreal and surreal it must have been. But it did involve her getting really depressed, and kind of falling into this depression that lasts for a really, really long time. Which meant we didn't really have a parent for a long time. Our kids, we were kind of left to fend for ourselves in this new landscape of like poverty, where we really didn't have food, we didn't have clothes. It's weird to talk about because the way I grew up is so removed from how most people grew up. You know, I grew up in the middle of the woods in a really small abandoned railroad boxcar that used to be part of a lumber railway. It was about 400 square feet, maybe. And we didn't have running water. We didn't have power. You know, we had outhouses and a wood stove. You know, and that's just how I grew up. When we didn't have food, and you know, there was a lot of things that sounds like it's just like taken out of a completely different era that makes up like the context of what my childhood was like. And that's not to make it sound like it's all bad. I mean, obviously this poem focuses heavily on the negative, just because the prompt is about, you know, when you peel back everything and really look at, like, what is it that you're made up of? You know, I was made up of a pretty rough start. But in a lot of ways now as an adult, it makes me appreciative of simple things. You know, turning a faucet on and having hot water is, like, that's crazy, you know? Not having to go chop wood to heat your house, like, that's awesome. You know, having a washer and dryer in the house, like, that's crazy. A car that I can just get in and drive and go where I want, you know, that was almost unfathomable for me at a time. The fact that I now own my own home is absolutely crazy. You know, the fact that I'm not still in this landscape of poverty is crazy to me sometimes. I have to like step back from myself and be like, I don't have to worry about, is there dinner tonight? I don't have to worry about if I get a hole in my shoe, do I, you know, just tape it up and walk like that? Like, those are concerns that I don't have to have anymore. You know, but in the hardest of times, it was about, you know, what is it that makes me is just like this insatiable hunger for like learning and escaping, you know, that's pretty much how I spent my whole youth, was just absorbing knowledge and information and reading and writing and just doing everything that I could to get myself out of, extract myself from that kind of lifestyle. And I am really happy that I've been as successful as I've been. And I'm also really happy that that's been true of my entire family, which is incredible. You know, not a single one of us, my mother or my five siblings, are living in poverty anymore, which the statistics on that are crazy. So I've just, I don't know, there's something about my family unit that just, we're indomitable in some ways. So I guess that's kind of what this is about. Sorry for this long rant.
No, that's all right. Thank you for sharing. I mean, I'm sorry that it was such a difficult start for you, and that, like, to be born already not well is very difficult. But you're resilient, and I'm so happy that you and your siblings and your mother have managed to get through and go on to bigger and better things and not be stuck in the troubles. I mean, like, you know, not perfect, but to be secure enough that, like, you – I mean, having a home, like, these days is actually almost impossible. I don't know. I feel like I'm never going to own one. I mean, I'm not homeless, but I, you know, buying one.
Renting and stuff, yeah. I mean, yeah. I feel incredibly lucky. Like, that's crazy. And living on the West Coast, I don't know. I feel sometimes it's just nuts to me that this is the case, but...
Well, I'm really proud of you for getting yourself together. That's amazing.
I have my moments.
Don't we all? No, thank you for giving that context. That, like, it adds layers to your poem, which was already good to start with, but now it's like it steps it up even more. Our next poet is Daniel Deschino, and it's called Reflective Pride. Reflective Pride. I am not a proud man, simply for the word man itself, as it does not allow me to be. As a man, I am no different than anyone else. I have created problems. I have hurt others. I have been shameful, and I have lived in fear. But for that does not come pride, simply from the word have and the chance for redemption. What is in the past, what has been left in the past, that is my morning definition. But it is not how I start my day, but how I finish that lets me sleep. Every morning is an opportunity. It is there whether I want it or not. Every evening is result. It is there whether I want it or not. What happens in between is up to me. I am a soldier born into a world at war, a world of billions and billions of soldiers fighting for daily existence. I need only choose my weapons. And when the man decides the weapon, and the weapon then decides the man. But alas, I have no real choice, for as I said before, I am but just a man, fragile and faulted, broken and battered, simple yet self-sovereign. So in the name of a clear conscience, there's really only one choice. Any weapon but compassion would be a defeat. Any strength but the bonds of unity with my brothers in arms would be self-destructive. And to hold strong in the shield of understanding and remove my selfish hard armor would free me to the victory of peace indeed. And this night of daily life will sleep well when the night of daily life comes and the pride of a battle well fought will bring the peace of sleep. And when the morning sun rises, the pride of days past will fall, and I, with the sun, will rise, a mere man in an army of men, to live, to fight again. End poem.
Great read, Ephesiana. I enjoyed this piece just, you know, to start off as, you know, I am not a proud man. You know, it's not the being a man that makes me proud. You know, it's what I do. It's being part of something bigger. You know, it's the tackling my days with compassion, you know, using weapons of togetherness, like weaponizing unity, essentially, to fight bigger foes. You know, that it's not just about being proud of yourself for just being a man, you know. And then I think in a lot of ways it kind of gets it, like, what does that mean? You know, like, you know, the I'm not perfect. You know, I'm a human being, so there's nothing really to be proud of in that. You know, where you can build something that you can be happy to wear, you know, to be comfortable with a label is to say that, you know, I was part of something bigger. I was part of a solution. I was part of being loving and compassionate and forgiving. And those are the things I fought for. And you can't fight for those things with violence. You know, I think it's a really empowering and uplifting message about, you know, how to be a part of the whole and how to use your day to get from one place to another a little bit at a time. You know, I did really like the concept of, you know, the days being an opportunity, you know, there whether you want them or not. Like, here's an opportunity. It doesn't really matter if you want it or not. You, like, you have these hours and you're going to have to do something with them. And whatever you do when you go to bed, you'll know exactly what you did and you'll live with those consequences. You know, and that applies to so many things. You know, did you go to work? You know, did you do something worthwhile today? Did you pig out on a bunch of food? Like, did you, you know, like, what did you do with your day? And are you happy with the results of that as you go to bed? And then if the answer is no, well, the good news is tomorrow is another opportunity to do something that you can be proud of. So I think there's a lot of strength in this. I think there's a lot of uplifting messaging in it that I think works well with the prompt as well. So I think it's a strong piece, and it's a very positive and uplifting piece. So wonderful write from Daniel. What did you think?
I agree, and I like that there's a strength in it that is not, like, you know, a toxic kind of, like, toxic masculinity strength. It's the kind of strength that, you know, he's strong and independent, but at the same time, he is, he's putting compassion as his weapon. He's not, in, like, a macho competition with the other men. He's talking about, like, people coming together and doing what they can, one little bit at a time, you know, taking manageable steps each day, doing what you can, and feeling okay about it at the end of the day of what you did, just in that one day, the small accomplishments, to not think about things that are done, the past ones. You're focusing on what you can do today. And I like that it says, like, you know, each day you choose your weapon. And to choose the weapon, quotation marks, of compassion is just, it's a really nice concept and kind of twist where it seems like, you know, he's at war, but really the war is just to survive society. It's to function. And I think this works really beautifully metaphorically for our life, but it also works for the show Sweet Tooth, because, you know, they're really in a fight for their survival. And Big Man, the character, I think, is someone who would kind of see it this way. And he used to be more of a fighter, and then he's choosing every day now to do the best he can to protect this child. And his weapon of choice right now is compassion throughout the show, where normally he might have, you know, been using his gun more. So I really think this works both for the show and for real life. And that's what I love to see in response to prompts, to see that it's you know, paying attention to the original quote or to the original source, but then it also twists it to be more personal or more reflective of our own society. And I think Daniel's really great at that. I've loved a lot of his responses to my prompts. He's really good at recognizing the contest and putting himself and our world into it. And I really love that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this makes me think of that quote, you know, bombing for peace is like having sex for virginity. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It just, you know, makes me think of that in the context of, you know, weaponizing kindness, you know, as a, you know, you can't fight war with war. Like, it doesn't work that way. So, I don't know. I thought this was a really good write and a really good take on the prompt as well, like you said. So, I enjoyed it. Where are we off to next?
We have one by T. Michelle, if you can read that for us.
Sure. This is an ode or something to my mind. I wonder if it is visible. A bald patch on the back of my head from scraping up and down my too tight chair and hitting too frequently the cubicle wires. Glancing at the clock, sweaty in an uncomfortable two-lapel pin suit while an aircon blasts on. Pitch black darkness of adulting swings as you tilt and talk to me. I wish I could have protected the child in us, the one that ages but doesn't grow, languages lost in our seared throat, gifts of broken pottery slapped across our young face. You know too well how my tongue sticks to my teeth and refuses to let go when I'm pushing through steam and fragments of poetry to meet the locked notes and pouring some lotion on veteran blue skin with conspicuous holes, and how my chest coughs up these painful constrictions when I don't say no. The air in July plunges into my lungs as I curl into myself and miss February's tender cold. We said our farewells too quickly. Four was too young to lose the colors of childhood. Was it such a distasteful thing to pay a little visit to saccharine stalls and inspect a little more closely the orange-brown eyes of wasps? To pet my aching feet, dine on shredded coconuts and lemon citrus burst. Little things shouldn't have costed that much. Look, my dear, at the pruning shears pointed towards migratory birds on the way to the next colony. One day, when the prune is over, I hope we'll also fly above sunshine to see silkworm mulberries and magenta orchids. All the hues of the years we missed. End poem. Do you want to comment on this one first? I have a loud train going by. Sorry.
Yes, that's fine. First of all, I should say this was for my other contest, so I should have said that in advance. This was actually for the one for Double Helix, but I missed that we had permission to read it, so I didn't, and we're doing it now. So... the prompt for this one was a little cartoon where the heart was trying to carry the brain up a rock climbing mountain, and is saying, why are we so heavy? Why are we so heavy? And then the brain is carrying a big bag of heavy past mistakes. And then they agree to drop the past mistakes, but the heart says, it's still too heavy. And then the brain is also carrying a big bag of fear of failure, and it's just weighing them down. So that was the prompt. And I thought this was a wonderful response to the prompt. You know, it's a little bit darker and more serious than the cartoon itself, but I really liked the way that that came out. I thought pitch black darkness of adulting was nice and relatable. Then I liked, you know too well how my tongue sticks to my teeth and refuses to let go when I'm pushing through steam and fragments of poetry. I thought that was an absolutely amazing section of the poem. And I think as a poet who sometimes, you know, has to deal with, like, the crazy emotions that come out in weird ways in my poetry, I really connected with that section. I thought the whole poem was really gorgeous in its wording and the way it's put together. And, like, it has, like, a small touch of humor, like a bald patch on the back of my head from scraping up and down to the too tight chair of the cubicle. I really like that image. It's fun. And yet there is this darkness to it. There's a part, four was too young to lose the colors of childhood. And four is definitely too young to lose that innocence. But it's so beautiful, the way that this is put together. I found it very touching. And all the hues of the years we missed is a beautiful closing line. I was very impressed with this, and I gave it silver in that contest.
Yeah, I really love this piece. I think this is an excellent write. You know, to me, it feels like somebody talking to their inner selves, you know, in different respects, like their ridiculous kind of co-adult and also their inner child, and having this conversation where they're like, you know, sitting. I love the starting part. You know, I wonder if it's visible, a bald patch on the back of my head from scraping up and down my too tight chair and hitting too frequently the cubicle wires, you know, the monotony of adulthood. You know, and I think that's a piece of adulthood that a lot of people really don't like, you know, is the fact that you're expected to do the same things day in and day out, to feed yourself, clothe yourself, pay your bills, go to work, you know, have these really kind of unfulfilling jobs, you know, it's kind of considered like a standard hallmark of adulthood, which in a lot of ways is really sad. And the idea of it being like the balding patch on the back of your head caused by that monotony, I think is a beautiful imagery. And you can just see someone twirling around in the same chair in the same spot every day, you know, and then the pitch black darkness of adulting swings as you tilt and talk to me. So now in my mind, this is now a conversation that you're having with yourself internally, almost like you're some kind of coworker, you know, like this multiple personality kind of thing happening, where it was just like, you know, I wish we could have protected the inner child, you know, we're broken. You know, and what do you do about it? So, you know, who knows you better than yourself? You know too well how my tongue sticks to my teeth and refuses to let go. Just the frustration and the anger, and just add that broken feeling and that sense of loss. You know, we said our farewells too quickly. Four was too young to lose the colors of childhood. You know, just to stop having that wonder and stop being that level of freedom at such a young age, which is something I relate to rather strongly. You know, I don't remember ever really feeling like a child. I may have been in the body of a child, but I felt like an adult from a pretty young age. You know, and just the sense of loss that really does kind of come, just not being able to do the things with
without that boding sense of responsibility weighing you down, I think is beautifully expressed here. You know, and just then that ending piece, one day when the prune is over, I hope we'll also fly above sunshine to see silkworm mulberries and magenta orchids, all the hues of the years we missed. You know, to reconnect with that inner child and to feel that freedom and to see the color flowing back into life, you know, to be able to look again at the world with the wonderment without the monotony, I think is beautifully expressed. I really enjoyed this piece. It's almost like a, you know, it says an ode or something to my mind, but for me it almost feels like a eulogy for an inner child. So I really liked this piece. I felt rather emotionally connected with it, which is, for me, what good writing is about. So I think that silver was well-deserved.
Well said. And I agree about, you know, it emotionally connecting is a really important part of poetry. It's something that stands out even more than any other kind of writing. I mean, I guess songwriting, which I still consider to be kind of an aspect of poetry. Because you can feel things in a novel, but poetry by its nature just seems to be emotional. And I tend to connect in emotional ways to most poems that are well done.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is by Kane, and it's for the contest of tonight, which I meant to do this one before I moved on to the other topics. By the way, I think we might have some extra time after we're done the ones that we have on the board. So if you had another poem of yours that you want to add, or if Victoria or Pam, who I know are listening, have a poem that you want to add, we are going to have time for you. Okay, I'm going to read this one now. Unintended Teachings by Kane. Every now and then, I think back when classrooms held my time of lines from a teacher who gave me a chance and, to my rhythm, a jaded step. Questions that linger still. Did you actually write this? If I look, will I find it somewhere else? The light inside poured out upon that sheet, and she looked at me as if my soul wasn't worthy. Honestly, in her shoes, I too would wonder. But that thunder provoked and awoke the slumber of a giant. Through time, a change of heart, a change of mind, I can't thank her enough for opening his eyes. Those lines have followed me all this way through the fray to say, stay strong, you've had it all along. And this was to prompt one, which was, when things fall apart, we find out who we really are.
Well, great read. And I really enjoyed this piece. You know, just this introspection that happens after a teacher basically accuses him or her of plagiarism. You know, did you actually write this? If I look, will I find it somewhere else? And just, like, the hurt from that, you know, and then the sense of, you know, imposter syndrome. Like, you know, well, did I write this? Like, it's just, you know, and then the anger. Like, you know, why can't I be good enough? Like, why is it so doubtful that I wrote this? Like, what is it about me that makes you think that I couldn't do it? That kind of thing. Which I think is something that a lot of people, especially writers, have experienced at some point, is just like when people get incredulous about things that you've done, and then, you know, you maybe overread into that a little bit, going, well, why is that so crazy? So I enjoyed that. And then just the fact that then it goes, no, you know what, thank you for basically saying that I did very well, like that you like this so much that you don't even think that I could do it all, but I can because I know that it came from me and I know that I did this so that I know it's something to be proud of. So I've enjoyed this piece. I thought it was well done and, you know, just the upwelling of emotion when someone accuses you of being fraudulent and all the different places it can take you. And then to end it on and be like, no, no, you know what? This is a compliment because you thought it was so good that it was like on the level of a professional or published or available somewhere else, which it isn't. So that's really a huge confidence booster and a big plus. So to take that giant jar of like jumbled emotions and to pin it out to something positive, I think is a great message. So I thought this was a good write. What did you think?
I thought the same, that it was a compliment to take it and good to take it that way, even though it's easy to take it as an insult, where it's like, you don't trust me, you think I'm someone who would cheat, you don't think I would be that talented, and yet you can take it as, I'm so talented that they don't believe that a child could do this. So there's that mix of feelings, and I like the way it kind of, I think at the time that it happened, they shut down because it provoked the giant who slumbered. But then later on, that giant woke up and reminded them that actually, you know, you always had this in you. There was always this talent, and you need to use it now. I thought that was a really interesting way to get into it, to have it as this a giant who slumbered until there was that change of heart. And yeah, it's really creative in the way that it puts that together. To my rhythm, a jaded step, to realize that there is this dishonesty and that people think that you're capable of doing it, you know, does tarnish you a little bit. And yet it is heartening to know that someone thought it was good enough, that it could have been someone else. There's that conflict there. And I thought this was really well developed. I find it interesting the way that it kind of accidentally, I think, makes an image, because of the way that the lines are long and then they are short and then they are long, there's this flow to it and how it looks physically that really intrigues me. And I liked that shift within it where it's sentences and then it goes down to just little one word, two words for a little bit because it emphasizes that part. Again, it's purposely abrupt, provoked, and awoke. The slumber of a giant. To have that section be kind of abrupt and then go back into the longer lines, it's like once that giant woke up, life restarted. I thought that was a really impressive way of subtly changing the tone.
Yeah, no, the great... Great point. Yeah, there is kind of a subtle shift in tone there. So, you know, I do feel like it matches well with that realization, you know, like, hey, no. So, you know, the self thought that goes with that. You know, like, wait a minute, this doesn't have to be a terrible thing, you know?
Yeah.
I don't have to take it that way. You know, you can choose your own outlook. You can. It's not that easy to do, but if you stop in a moment and you do think, like, how can I take this positively, you can successfully do that. You don't have to be angry or upset. But, you know, kind of touches on that in a little bit. You know, how can I take this in a positive way? So I thought it was a well-done piece.
Agreed.
Where are we off to next?
Now we're going to do our second one by Lynn. And that is from the State of Mind contest. That was originally for Double Helix, but it was carried over because we thought Lynn was going to call in, and so we waited till the end, and then we lost track of time and forgot to go back to it. So we don't want to miss it out. Pam, can we please have the audio to House Cleaning and Other Guilt Trips?
House Cleaning and Other Guilt Trips. Little did we know, there's no such thing as perfection. The more we grasped for it, the further it got away. Perfection in one area meant neglect elsewhere. Why did nobody tell us life is all about balance? Just trying to give our best is all we can do, never achieving elusive perfection, but balancing what's most important.
Great read. I really enjoyed this piece. You know, just the idea that perfection is unachievable in so many ways. You know, there really is nobody out there who's perfect. That's not a thing. They have some kind of flaw, especially since what some people consider perfect, other people don't. You know, I remember going and visiting my aunt's house when I was 17, and my mom's side of the family is really wealthy, but my mom is not really included in that for whatever reason. And I go to visit their house, and everything is absolutely immaculate. Like, just, it looks like you're walking into a museum. Everything's like white marble. The couches are white. You know, the walls look like a gallery. And it was the most uncomfortable living space I'd ever been in. Like, I was afraid to sit on anything. You know, what if I dirty the couch? Or what if I don't put something back just right? You know, so while that might be somebody's, like, perfect home, I was so uncomfortable there. It just makes me think of that because, you know, what you think is perfection may not be somebody else's perfection. So perfection doesn't really exist. And striving to be perfect in all areas just really kind of sets you up for failure. You know, the closest anyone can ever actually get to perfection is to just to do as many things as they can in moderation, essentially. You know, the goal isn't to be the best at everything. It's to do your best at everything. And there's a difference. And I think this gets at that really nicely. As a little bit of a tangent, I was talking to my mom the other day about my brother and how I think he's going to live to be a really, really old man because people on my mom's side of the family live a really long time and people on his dad's side of the family live a really long time. And he's not really tall and he's not really thin and he does, like, everything in moderation. He's, like, very good at doing everything moderately. He eats mostly healthy and occasionally doesn't. And, you know, he doesn't really get stressed out about that many things. You know, like, he's very moderate in most of the ways that he lives. So I think my brother is setting himself up to live a really, really long time. it just made me think of that just because we were just talking about that. But, yeah, perfection in one area meant neglect elsewhere. Why did nobody tell us life is all about balance? It really is. It's all about balance, you know, and maybe tilting it one way or another, depending on what's important to you at a certain time. So I thought this was a lovely piece. I thought it was a nice brevity about a certain kind of worldview. I especially liked the title, House Cleaning and Other Guilt Trips. I'm someone who will cook dinner and make a bunch of dishes and then eat my dinner and not do the dishes. And maybe I'll do the dishes in the morning or maybe I'll do the dishes in a couple days. And my rationality is always like, well, they'll still be there. and of course then my husband does the dishes because he's like, well, they should be done now. Beauty of it, neither one of us is wrong. It's just about your priorities and when you want to do things. So, I enjoyed this piece. It really felt lighthearted and sentimental at the same time. What did you think, Capiziana?
I really loved it. I feel like this is a topic that really touches me because, I'm chronically ill and sort of disabled, and I really like the spoon theory. So it's this thing that is popular amongst chronically ill people or chronic fatigue people, where there's this woman, I can't remember her name now, who explained to her friends how it feels to not have any energy because you're not well. And so she was like, everybody else, most healthy people start with 100 spoons full of sugar, or full of whatever, but we're going to say sugar, full of sugar, and each thing that you do in a day takes a spoon. So if you go to work, that's a certain amount of spoons. If you do, like, whatever, it's going to be spoons. But most people have 100, so they don't worry about it. They do all the things. And when you're not well, you start off with less spoons. You might only have 10 spoons. And it takes one spoon to have a shower. And it takes 2 spoons to cook yourself dinner. And it would take 2 spoons to clean up. But you have to save that because you also have to do, like, this radio show, which maybe that will take a spoon or two. And then every little thing takes a spoon. So I've learned since I've been not well that you really have to prioritize. And you can't do all the things. You know, I can be great at work, or I can be great at home, or I can have a social life. I can't do all three. You have to choose. And I think that to a certain extent, everyone has to deal with that. But it's become, like, more obvious of, like, you really have to choose which thing you're going to do today. And I don't know, this touches me personally because I've really been struggling the last couple of years with making those decisions of, like, what do I cut, because I can't possibly do everything. And I don't know, I just really feel this. But again, Lynn has such a, like, sweet, calming voice that it's like, it softens the blow of the truth. And never achieving elusive perfection, but balancing what's most important. I think these are words of wisdom that we have to get, because I know, like, there's been this pressure of, like, to have it all, especially for women, I find, whereas, like, you know, there's this kind of expectation of, like, the 50s housewife who can, like, you know, make the house pristine and cook the beautiful dinner and do all the things, except they had all day to do it. And if you're at work for 8 or more hours a day and you have other things that you have to be doing, to do it all is exhausting. And I don't even have kids to take care of. So, I don't know.
Yeah,
like, how do people do it?
Yeah, I read this article the other day that said, like, modern women are expected to work like they don't have children and a home to take care of, and they're expected to take care of their children and a home like they don't work. And it's like, well, that's not, I mean, that's just not the reality. So, you know, like, wow, that's not fair. You know, which is kind of sad, but I know too many people who are in that boat. But, yeah, I mean, I've also heard of spoon theory. For me, I get decision fatigue. You know, I have anxiety and I get race, that kind of stuff. And so there's only so many choices I can make in a day before I can't really make any decisions. I know that sounds – that people don't always understand what exactly that means. But, I mean, like, I'll say that I'll do something and then I will just completely forget. And it's not like I didn't want to do it. It's just it just went right out of my mind. Or I'll have a really busy day at work where I work in a high-level, director-level position, and I have to make, like, 1,000 executive decisions in a day. And then when I get home, I don't want to think about what to eat for dinner. And even if you take me out to dinner, that's stressful because I don't want to look at a menu. Like, I don't want to pick. Like, I just, like, the idea of making that choice is overwhelming and too much for me.
Oh, I get it. I've had problems where, like, I can't even pick what to watch on TV, which is, like, a stupid thing. Like, I should not be stressed about it. But I'll look at Netflix at all the options, and I'm like, I can't. And I'll end up choosing something that I've seen a million times just because I'm like, it's the first option, and I can't. go through this right now. I'm like,
yeah.
I just need to veg out.
And it's like, I literally can't, and it's hard to explain, you know, and then it applies to other things as well, you know, just, you know, putting my keys somewhere where I can find them. You know, that's a decision. Decision fatigue, you know, and you're done making decisions, well, then you just set them wherever, and you're not going to remember where the heck you put them because you didn't put them in the place where you're supposed to put them. So it sounds
yeah.
really easy to just be like, well, just pick a spot and put in that spot all the time. Well, that's a thing I have to remember to do and have to decide to do. And if I had a really hard day, there's a really good chance I'm not going to remember that or be able to do it, as ridiculous as that sounds. So,
no, you lose your executive functioning. I totally get it.
It's gone. My brain is melted.
Yeah.
So.
There were about 6 months where I only had 4 hours of executive function. After that, I was done. Like, you know, I could do whatever you needed me to do for 4 hours, but then I would just shut right down.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily,
yeah.
I'm at about 8 hours now.
That's good. It is funny, though, when people don't get it at all, though. I mean, it's funny in a kind of frustrating way, but it's also, you know, where they're like, why don't you just X? And I'm like, oh, man, that is a big can of worms. you know, what if I could, man? What if I could? Like, there's no malice or ill intent in me not doing it. It's not like I just didn't do it to piss you off. Like... Anyway.
I get it. Spoonies. It's
no.
quite the online community. We now have one by Rebecca Robinson. So, Pam, this one has an audio. She might be called Bex, B-E-X. She sometimes does that for her audios.
Maybe.
Are you quiet because you're waiting for me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I will go ahead and play that SoundCloud. And here we go.
Slipping through the extreme.
Wow. That was, I mean, I wasn't expecting it to be so musical. I really enjoyed this. I mean, first of all, it was very musical, which was a nice departure. But also just the concept, you know, when did we lose our empathy? Like, when did we stop caring about other people? I don't know. I get the impression of this, everybody kind of lost in their own world, you know, waving your arms like they're leaves side to side. No one speaks. Rock our heads to melody. Knock regrets to Sunday. Flicking ashes in an ashtray. Cigarettes and Hennessy. Checks and ecstasy. You know, it's very hedonistic. You know, it's about, it almost feels like nihilism, you know, just doing things to please yourself and make yourself feel good and not really caring about how that impacts or affects other people. Just living in a moment of hedonistic self-pleasure at the expense of everyone and everything else because we don't care about them anymore. I thought it was a pretty interesting concept. You know, and then to get more blunt about it later in the piece, you know, where's our sympathy to fellow human being? 1% has trillions. It's a pyramid scheme adopted mainstream. You know, there's these people that have, like, amassed this incredible amount of wealth, and what about everybody else, you know? And yet nobody really balks at it or bats an eye because we've just made it the norm, you know, and why is that the norm? And then assuming worst first, no one seems concerned until it's their turn. Pay it forward's rapture. No one wants disaster, you know. Just really not caring until it affects you personally, which, you know, that's too late. Because then guess what? Nobody cares that it's happening to you because you aren't them. You know, or worse, there's nobody even left to care. So I thought this was really interesting, you know, just as a concept. Just really kind of talking about people living in bubbles of selfishness. So I thought it was an intriguing write. What did you think?
I loved it. Becca is so talented in the way she puts her poetry to music. I think that it works nicely to have the repetition of when did we lose our empathy, that it's two times in a row every time, and that it happens several times in the song. It really emphasizes that is the key to this. And, you know, what did happen to us that we lost that ability to care and to make a difference for people who don't necessarily share our situation right now, because like that point that you pointed out where they don't care until it's happening to them, and then that's too late, and that we need to care before it's happening to ourselves or to someone who we care about. I liked the part where it was the contrast between the people who don't care and the people who do. So we're crying in our sleepwalk while the day walkers gawk. They're shouting, get a job, while Samaritans sob. So for me, I'm picturing, like, I work downtown, and there's a lot of homeless population in that area. And there's two kinds of city dwellers who deal with walking down that street. And some of them are very aggressive, yelling at people to get a job. And then the other ones are, like, super empathetic to the other extreme and are just, like, crying and wanting this to change, but not really necessarily doing anything about it, just feeling it. And it kind of becomes about them and their feelings. Honestly, I probably fall more into that category, but I think that talking about the two extremes there is interesting. And our sleepwalk, I think it's kind of like how we kind of are dazed and just keep going throughout life, not really seeing what's happening, or those who are noticing what's happening, kind of gawking and being like, "How is this going on?" But the part about like the 1% having everything, and I like that it's referred to as the pyramid scheme, and the rhyming there with mainstream worked out really nicely. Yeah, Becca's writing, as usual, makes you think and just sounds beautiful. So thank you so much, Rebecca Robinson, for this audio. And next I'm going to get you, Babbler, to read the one from Victoria.
All righty. This is Untitled by Victoria Frost. And it goes like this. Weighted beneath rotted rags, bloodshot eyes peeked out. It did not matter that festering wounds refused to heal. Shrouded in a cloak of darkness, trepidation sat upon my shoulder, whispering how I am helpless. No amount of knee-high boots or bold black lipstick would wipe away mascara-stained cheeks. Yet deep within the black oblivion, a will to crawl out sparked to life, digging up against the hands that pushed me down, feeling their nails rake my skin. Their whispers became a roar of reminder. Each failure screamed until my ears rang and spurred on my will to leave, to breathe against their crushing weight, to feel my arms spread in the cool air, the warm of the unknown sun hot against my skin. This pit of depression can no longer claim my soul. End poem. Victoria. I enjoyed this piece, you know, just about escaping a depression. I like the concept of, you know, shrouded in a cloak of darkness, trepidation sat upon my shoulder, whispering how I'm helpless. You know, as someone who struggles with depression, like, it sometimes really does feel like an additional presence, at least for me. You know, it's like I have my rational voice, and then there's this irrational voice that says horrible things all the time. I almost pictured, like, a crow or something, you know, sitting on her shoulder just squawking terrible things. Which was great imagery for me, you know, and then the idea that there's no amount of knee-high boots or bold black lipstick that's going to solve this. If anything, I think dressing that way and using that method of self-expression is like putting on an armor, you know. It's like maybe the black mascara that's running down my cheeks won't look so out of place if I dress this way. Not to say, of course, that like all goths are like that or anything. But to me, it feels like almost a form of masking or armor in this particular kind of scenario. And then the uprising of, you know, the will to live, the will to crawl out sparked to life. Almost picture like a zombie or something scraping its way out of a coffin, you know, just to you know, be out, to climb out, to become undead in a way. I just really enjoyed the imagery of this piece. I thought it was really well done about, you know, just the rising from the depths of a crushing depression, and the pit of depression can no longer claim my soul. I thought it was wonderfully written, and I don't know why, but for some reason my brain just really latched on to the concept of a crow for this one, maybe just because the dark imagery plus the idea of taking flight at the same time. I enjoyed it. I felt like it was a very strong write about going from somewhere dark to somewhere better. And what did you think, Faziana?
I really liked it, too. I love the ending there, the pit of depression can no longer claim my soul, but I love the recognition of how heavy that depression can be. Trepidation sat on my shoulder is really great because it does actually sometimes feel like physically heavy when you're really depressed. I feel like there's like a weighted blanket or like a wet blanket that is like on top of me, pressing me down. And I think that to have trepidation sit on you is really a nice metaphor in that way. Weighted beneath the rotten rags also kind of catches on that. And the idea that the wounds are festering, that these metaphorical wounds are still infecting your thoughts, which you see again through whispering how I'm helpless, and then each failure screamed until my ears rang, and that kind of negative self-talk that you can get stuck in is really nicely explored here. I also liked the imagery of the no amount of knee-high boots or bold black lipstick would wipe away mascara-stained cheeks. So, like you said, even though you have, like, that kind of tough goth look, maybe that was put on to help mask the fact that even if you were trying to be, like, soft and more, like, kind of, like, maybe traditional feminine, that the mascara would smear anyway, you're going to have those black streaks down your face. So make it a part of your look. Wear it as armor, like you said, Babbler. I thought that that was a really nice touch to this. And I like that it's in the middle. So it's like you think about like the metaphorical stuff, and then you see what it might literally look like, and then it goes back into the metaphor. And the end does have that empoweringness of, like, she's going to get out of this. She has been sparked to life, and it's no longer going to claim her soul. She's going to spread her arms in the cool air. I thought this was a really powerful piece. I really connected with it. Thank you, Victoria, for sharing this.
Mm-hmm. Neat. Where to next?
Did you just read that or did I? I've totally lost track. You read it. I'm going to read the one by Pam.
All right.
Go. Observation by Pam Ray. Disgraced, debased, embraced, foretaste. The disgraced embraced the wicked seed, foretaste of the debased will of greed. Peering, leering, sneering, bleeding, peering and leering from branches high, the sneering crows watch the bleeding die. End poem. You were just talking about crows.
Yeah. Yeah, but I guess my brain had this weird little premonition. Maybe that's why I kept picturing crows. I don't know. really liked this, though. It has a real creep vibe with just the four words, and they all feel very negative, you know, disgraced, debased. And while embraced can be positive, when tucked in with those other words, it just... and then... The following couplet that tucks them all neatly into a sentence, you know, the disgraced embraced the wicked seed for taste of the debased will of greed, you know, just giving in to wickedness and greed and just being lured and tempted by that. And then the peering, leering, sneering, and bleeding, you know, the idea that there's just these... crows just watching it all happen, you know, just waiting to come down and like feast upon the carrion. It's just really dark and disturbing, and it has this wonderful like foreboding feel to it that I really like. So I thought this was a great piece. I think the title went really well with it as well. Wonderful work, Pam. Very, very, I don't know, lingering kind of brevity. So I thought it was an excellent write. What did you think, Faziana?
I really loved her word choices. You know, like, There are a lot of words that can end in ED to rhyme, but she chose really great words that went together, like ones that are not super prevalent, like debased and foretaste. They aren't the cliche words you would expect in a poem. They go beyond that. And I really loved how the format of it, where it used the individual words and then it went into a longer thing. But I clicked the link in her AN, and she was doing a Tyburn poem, which is a 6-line poem consisting of 2-2-2-2-9-9 syllables. And the first 4 lines rhyme and are all descriptive words. The last 2 lines rhyme and incorporate the first, second, third, and fourth lines as the 5th through 8th syllables. So that's really interesting. I've never heard of this format before, I confess, and I really like it. I think I'm going to have to try to write a Tyburn. So thank you, Pam, for introducing this to me.
It has a really specific format, too, so great work. But, yeah, interesting. I like how dark it is. It's a very dark, foreboding piece. I really enjoy it. So excellent use of a new format. Yeah, that'll be fun to play with. All right. Well, I'm not sure that we have time for another one. But anything you wanted to say, Faziana?
Well, will you tell them about your contest for next week?
Oh yeah. So next week's contest is inspired by Nietzsche. It's a series of quotes that I chose to you know, prompt some inspiration, just looking at different ways of worldviews. I mean, obviously Nietzsche was a philosopher, but it's not even too much about the philosophy aspect of him as it is about some of his more poetic writings and just some of the ways that he has written in his works that, I don't know, I feel like are more emotional line writes than you might expect. So I thought that this might get people's brains going and kind of pique some ideas. So I'm curious to see what people come up with and what they have to say. I'm always a big believer in that there's no wrong answers, you know. So whatever direction you spin off into, you know, as weird and tangential as it might seem, I am loving the idea of reading it. Bring it. So that's what the contest is for next week.
I'm excited to hear what people read. I mean, what people write. I wrote one to it yesterday. I should have been writing for tonight's theme, but I got sidetracked and wrote to that one. You know, because I never do things in the proper order. I have ideas for the one that we did tonight, but I never got them wrangled. So I wrote for next week, and I really enjoyed it. I think I want to write another one based on the other quotes. So I'm very excited to read what people come up with. And we're wrapping up. So thank you, Babbler, for everything that you've done. Thank you to Pam for working behind the scenes for us. Thank you to Phil for giving us the show. Thank you to Victoria for hanging out on the board. And thank you to all of the poets who shared their writing and their audios. And we just love getting to promote your writing. So please continue to enter our contest. And if you like the shows, please support us through the anthologies that are based on the shows and are available through Amazon. Good night, everyone.
Night. Thank you guys for joining us.